Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about automation update number 4. Now, in this episode, I'll cover using ampersands in the the documentation for a podcast, so it picks it out and automatically puts it in a finder word, just smoothing that out. Also, automatic archiving of the actual podcast container. There's a software container automatically archives it, and then I'll get into some more complex theory about where you place assets, physically where you place them, and educationally where you place particular assets. Now, the overall situation of podcasting is that I'm trying to actually it's always a battle between the rehabilitation targets that you're aiming for and what they are, and trying to get in the correct support and do the best exercise possible to achieve that, to get the actual podcasts themselves out, but also if you're getting out several podcasts a day and you do something and it's you can structure something that's less steps involves, less cognitive load, it takes a shorter time and less load on it. So that's something you have to sort of weigh up. Do you do it or don't you do it? Or do you actually think about it? Or do you let it percolate in the background? And then you have the long-term thing of ultimately you want to write an executable and distribute the executable to friends so they can continually, they can also podcast using the same systems that you have. So if you simplify it for yourself, you're also simplifying it for them further down the track. So all these things, trade-offs, like the amount of podcasts you put out the day, or the amount of research that you actually put into seeing where you want to actually go with rehabilitation, what are the obstacles. And like, I'm not expert on this, I'm really an amateur on this, and I'm just using my own common sense to try and work out what I have to do. And so, as you would have heard from the very early podcast to the most recent podcast, there's just been a general improvement in the flow of words and thoughts and structures and stuff like that, and the communication structure to actually finally get good communication in the classroom. And if you don't have necessarily a lot to communicate, there's not a lot to actually sort out, or not many as many traps to get apart. So rather than having a sort of a model that there is the ideal communicator and they just walk in and that they take the prize and walk out, I've got a sort of a different model that is that you're the communicator that you are, and you have to actually realistically identify what the deficiencies are and the path forward. Now, the deficiency may be due to, say, having a lot of detailed technical information, being able to actually pass that in a container which is usable for kids. And there's obviously some quick solutions, but then there's some longer term solutions, that is putting that information in structured apps so that people at different levels can get into it, putting it into learning resources. There's a whole series of things, networking it with experts in order to deliver quality at the over end. So there's this quality by attributes, which is the quality teaching models. That you say if you have these attributes, you will have quality, which is sort of emergent in terms of business theory. It's an emergent quality by just policing the do's and don'ts, sort of like a road law. Putting in the road laws, having the traffic, and obviously the traffic follows the road laws and everything's right. It should work. It's that theory there. That's one access address to quality, and that sort of assumes that you know all the actual how things are done and why things are done and where things are going to go. If you know all those things, you can then come in quite authoritatively and say what should be done. But fundamentally, what we do know and what's been taught, what has been taught is only just a small fraction of what we do know, and it's the logic there doesn't go there, it doesn't correspond. So the people who are teaching just what they know is in that sort of closed group of what they know, so the facts marry up with the set of facts that they have. They have a way of processing which is based on the logic within that closed group of knowledge, that if it's outside the group of knowledge, it's not necessary. But quite practically, obviously, people's lives and the economy and stuff relies on the advanced technology that we are developing, quantum mechanics, quantum computing, advanced computer mathematics concepts are actually driving the human race when you actually actually get into it, and providing ways that people can communicate. So people, we look at the people are now always connected. People can now insult people at the speed of light. That's the speed at which communications occur. The speed of light and the information, an insult can travel around the world in what, a few milliseconds. What is it? Well, it's, oh, I was trying to think. Is it, oh yeah, well, it can travel around in 50 milliseconds easily. Easily can get, you can really insult someone at that incredible speed, faster than you can, almost faster than you can think, you can actually send an insult around the world and back again. You can insult not one, but millions of people now by the technology that, that we have. So there's that aspect. One is the knowledge worlds and our sort of theories of knowledge that, you know, that we can say, well, we've got to do better. But also the actual emergent, what we're teaching into is a different thing. And it's not that it's this A or B. It's just we really don't technically know for it. We are actually building a service, an adaptable service for an unknown future. That's what we're actually trying to do. And so with all that, you've got different things coming in, and that filters back into the strategy. So you've got a strategy of rehabilitation, the strategy of the actual strategies that you put across, and your software strategies. And some of it's deliberate, some of it's just emergent. So let's go through the three areas that I've said I would talk about. One is in writing the title, the content of the blog, and the quiz, use words. And I had noted that I would think of the three words to put in the finder word, and occasionally I would look up the page for inspiration. So what I've done is that if I put an ampersand in front of a word, that word will then be, it will search the string for an ampersand and then search for the next space and then cut that out and put that word and space in a string. And so it will search through the text and then search through the quiz and automatically write into the array at the base the actual set of finder words. And so in general, I think 30 seconds a minute, but that's 10 minutes a day if you're doing 10 podcasts to go across. And it's not an idle minute, it's a minute of thinking and testing to go across. So not only do you have to type, you have to actually check that you've typed correctly. So this ampersand stuff, it can be in your, when you, forces you to review what you've written and actually put in things there. So it sort of removes the load to doing the finder word. Now, why the finder word? Oh, well, I suppose goal is to sort of meet and exceed the requirement or the idea of having a finder word for year 7 and when they come in to the classroom. can be one aspect. They may or may not use it, but it's something for which software is designed rather than you thinking and scrambling the word, or do you get the word actually scrambled yourself rather than one. You have three words of different complexity to see if you can actually get through it. It's asynchronous, so you've got all those things that you can get to, but then you want to cut down the load even more, and then this is by putting ampersands through it. And now, as has happened, I have you give podcasts, so that's closed that one off. So you can just type, go through your text that you're putting out for your blog, put a few ampersands in, three ampersands. I think I've got it up to three stuff. So what is it? It's the actual software is really zombie software. So it's takes the actual brain out of a piece of developed software and replaces it with your work. There's a search and replace that you can actually do inside some software. So it's just very simple to do, and it's a bit clunky, memory intensive, but it also means that your little folder is a standalone container of your podcasts and the teaching resources. So you can actually you can go up to the net and copy that folder, say download that folder, and that folder will go in your computer and it will work anywhere without internet connection with a hot wall. Yeah, the podcast will work without internet connection at all. It's a sort of a truly portable device. That's so when you're writing up, say I'm doing a series on maths or doing a series on a particular set of philosophers, and for various strong reasons that you do a series because things take a while to go, and you are doing rehab, so you might actually only be able to podcast initially for 10, 20 minutes. I'll see if I can get up to 30 minutes, 40 minutes, an hour, or eventually get to that level. What you're doing, it's a very similar podcast, so what you really want to do is, if you can imagine your podcast having the album cover, which I put with it, but it's sort of a construction album cover, which gives the quiz and the various things, and the find a word, and the write-up and the date and stuff like that. So essentially you want to actually just store that album cover or that container of that podcast on your computer in a temporary way. So there's certain ways you want to store it. You want to store it in a successive database file, so that when you come along to eventually build the apps which operate these areas, you can do that easily. And so I've sort of just got it as it's going through, just recording the information. Well, I've got to really think, is that what I really want to do? I've got to really, really think about that. So this is the entire thing, is that that you've got a long-term objective and you may deploy different ways. Now, this for me is the more disturbing, or it's a little bit disturbing for me. What do you say? Oh, hang on. If you actually don't know how you've done something, it's actually very disturbing. Sort of like the police come up and say, that broken window, there's footage of you doing it. Unfortunately, you have to say, look, I really have got no idea how it's done. Obviously, in this case, it's not a broken window. But to really understand, everyone I think can understand that a podcast is an MP3 file, and you can take the raw MP3 file and actually encapsulate it, bit rate control, do all this stuff, and then store it. And then you want to store it with some text and a label, some pictures, some links to quizzes, to apps, sort of standardized stuff. And you want to have that professional. And unfortunately, you can't. Well, I haven't been able to click away on my professional attribute through it. And the reason, and it's not entirely clear when you first decide, look, I'm going to go, I have to go in that direction. It's not clear to you that people will hide bits of the software environment from you, that you simply can't do various things. So you can't say in a blog, you can't put up an image that you've uploaded to your crappy HPP. Then you have to actually load the image on Google and actually use Google's HPPTS, that secure system. I don't know what HPPT, is it HTTP? I think it's HTTP. But yeah, it's HTTPS, hypertext, text protocol, something like that, secure. So you have to do that. So there's all these blocks coming up. So you have the issue of all this information, which is put in LabVIEW or programmer-friendly stuff. If you want a string, so it's important that the computer knows the data type. So you actually put a control, which is your data that you're going to enter, but it's in a container of its data type, and then that containers are grouped in an area of a page, a region of the page. That region is called a cluster, which is like is. When it comes together, that's a really yucky data type with all these other sub-data types arranged higgledy-piggledy. And then underneath that cluster, you want to say, well, I want different instances of that cluster. You want to put it in an array, sort of like a list, a shopping list or a class list of names. It could be like a file list of names, say for a student, you've got the student's name, picture, their results and various things. It's like a record. And so this is not quite databases, this is a more controlled array. So an array is like a matrix, 1 degree, 2 degree matrices. I generally use 1 degree matrices, and you have to use that matrix. And what happens is that as you are looking at the series of, so I get it to record the podcast done today and yesterday, and podcasts, so sometimes you might be doing 30 seconds and you're interrupted, so you abandon that. So what it does is it filters out podcasts which are less than 3 minutes long. So podcasts greater than 3 minutes, podcasts greater than 3 minutes and today and yesterday, go through them. But even then, you click on, you can then you create a list, a ordered list off to the side of the actual, so it's called a list element. So the list element has items in it. You feed in the item names being the file titles. You click on the file title. I suppose you get a double click. I don't know how. You click on the file title, and if you want to listen to it, you just press listen and play across. And this is an example of being able to just remove the overhead. So what happens is you put in your USB thing, it detects it and automatically purges your USB, sort of just automatically it's waiting there, and it actually puts in your dictaphone, you put it into the computer, it automatically takes it up and it gets ready to edit it. There's no sort of steps involved in that. And the files that you've done appear up, and you click on the file, it opens up its menu for it. And not the menu, the cluster of it, which is the name, the blurb, the front cover, a table, basically, which is the quiz questions that you put in, and now the final word. And we've just discussed that the final word is actually now harvested from the other information that you put in. So that's a cluster. And what happens is that each you do a podcast, you speak into a podcast, so the computer can't listen to it. You have to listen to it. And so ideally what happens is if you do one podcast, you want to actually, you've done one podcast in the series, you want the initial first draft of what you should describe this next podcast in the series published up there. It's all good. I think every aspect of it's there. I'm just thinking. So you want to be able to take a LabVIEW data type and cast it to a file to be saved. And so this is where sort of the brain burnout is. I sort of remember a long time being able to do a data log file. where you put the file type in. I played around it for a while, and strangely, I had this image of how it was done, but I couldn't work it out because there's things I had never seen before in LabVIEW. And this is sort of like the spooky stuff, is that although you've never seen it before, never experienced it before, it's already outlaid there for you to follow the overall structure of it. And so there's two aspects. I'll explain for LabVIEW programmers how it's done, but also the idea of putting one program and then splitting it into two subroutines at the end of it. So I'll try and explain. So you've got this array of clusters, and you want to actually convert that into text, because files store either binary or text, and they're not necessarily very good at storing. And you can have a database file, which is binary and text. And so this is sort of halfway between a database file. So it's a LabVIEW object called a variant. So when the variant comes out, comes out with just the raw data of what's in each individual cluster. So say for the third array element, you'll have a brackets 3 dash dash in inverted commas, just the data with commas after it. You know, this is here. To be honest, I can't, if you've got an array, it would just say the size of the array. So for a string array, so there's booleans, all this type of stuff. So it spits that out as a variant. And then looks something you could save, but the variant is not a string. It's not a data type string which could be fed to a file. So a string is just basically text, like you pick up a book. It's written in a book. It's all computer print. A string is something you can print out or see on a screen. So you put that to convert variant to string. So there's a VR which converts it to a string, and it converts it to two things. It converts it to a string and an array of unsigned 32-bit numbers for some reason. And that 32-bit numbers, that array of numbers is translated by LabVIEW into the data types, so it allows it to actually interpret what's going on. So you've got your cluster, and we've converted the cluster to a variant, the variant to a string and a linear array data type. And then that was a bit of a head scratcher, that's a bit of a dead end. However, I had just in my mind the way to do it, even though I hadn't actually seen any of this. So this is a bit of the spooky part. I was actually saying, oh, look, I have to do this, and it just fell out. And so I then converted so we've now got the information of all the front covers that you have up there, and this is the scratch pad of front cover. So the overall problem is that while the computer's on, it will remember sort of volatile information, but if you switch the computer off, it brains or has a crash, you'll lose all the non-volatile data. So you've got to actually convert your volatile data, which is a scratch pad of all the containers. So if you click through to a previous container and say that's what I want to do, you click on it and it automatically writes everything in, and it may be episode 24, and so you then go in, change 24 to 25 in a few places, add a bit more, modify some of the questions to be more appropriate for it, put in a few ampersands around it, and Bob's your uncle, you can actually speed through. Or if the worst comes to the worst, you listen to something and you get the podcast wrong, so you've got the two podcasts, one, two containers, you can go back and reissue the podcast with the proper container for it. So it's to link up with that. So we've got the container, we've converted the container to a variant, we've converted the variant to a string and a linear array. We can convert that linear array of string into a spreadsheet string, because it's an array, it's like a spreadsheet, like an Excel spreadsheet. And then you then have a spreadsheet string and the data string, and then you bind the three, oh, you bind those two together, and you have to get the computer to be able to break it apart afterwards, after you've stored it. So I have this symbol, which I have, which is not used by anyone, and it's a three symbol, three letter symbol, and that's exclamation mark X, exclamation mark. That's just something that I've, you know, if you ever see a piece of code and that's in there, that's my stuff for where you've got these software declared special characters and you just don't want to use it. You want to have your own special character. And you can't use the forward slashes because the forward slash is interpreted by different software in different ways. Or it's a forward slash is progressively stripped off as you go down to deep levels of the software, so it's like it's a complex thing using that. So I have my own thing, and so that produces a single string. So your all your data, which is in an array of cluster, gets variant into a data string and or an array and a data string. The array of numbers is converted to yet another string. And then there's two strings. So a string is like a text, a paragraph, or some actual written text. And then that's bound together with a delimiter, a separator. I suppose you could, I don't know what you could do with it. I suppose there was a different way. And then that's stored to a file name. And then at the same thing, write a file and then you connect the file name directly onto a reader file, and then you take the text out of that, and then you divide the text with that separator symbol into two, and then you put that text back into back into the data format. By soaking up the converting the text the text spreadsheet text back into an array, then feed that array back into a subroutine which converts text given the array back into data, and then feed the data into a container which is a clone of the container that you started off with, and there you go. So you can test that as one program across, and then you successively break the wires. So I had a wire with the file name in and transferred it across because I know I'm going to break it. It's sort of like a cell division. I then copy the name of that wire and sort of duplicate it, so that's across. So the file name exists on both, and then copy the exclamation mark X exclamation mark. I'll put a code of this up here. And put that across. Yeah, and that's it. And so you save the file twice with store and recall file.vi, and then you then for the store one you eliminate the recall bit, and for the recall bit you eliminate the store bit. It couldn't be simpler. And then this is a virtual instrument. You wire up the front panels, then drop it in, and then basically at the start, this is for your scratch pad. At start is refresh the scratch pad, and when you finish using the scratch pad and you're off to push it off to the internet, it then stores it, the scratch pad out there. So that's a way of storing it. Now this is just at the start of it. I'll then have so you can have on a scratch pad, on the scratch pad you can just have there you have copy or something like that. I've forgotten the name. It's C something or other. And it takes that and actually you press it. That's what I want in my container. So it simplifies it across. So your overall theory is that you're putting in these hours of work. But then they're not hours that you predict. So, like, I couldn't have predicted that the solution to a complex problem would just pop out. So what happens is you go onto some of the internet forums, the LabVIEW forums, and you go, this, a lot of people haven't actually really thought through the overall thing that you want to do. People are concerned about storing their data, but they haven't actually thought through, well, I have to convert my data to a string at all costs, and then it completely into a string. So that they sort of, there's these solutions out there which are sort of hard to navigate. Now I'm sure there's other solution paths out there, but that's worked in a very short time. And so it's a very hard thing to actually strategically judge, you know, that you want to actually have something which is fast, but also operates when you're tired, so that when you're producing a large amount of these things, that the cognitive load of actually producing it is reduced and handled. And of course, once you actually start to, in the back of your mind, saying, "Oh, wouldn't that be? Oh, I wonder how that is," and then at the back of your mind, it just pops out. There's this overhead of if you decide not to solve the problem, you've got that space in your head of stored with, well, don't forget how to solve that problem. So now that I've solved it, I can forget about it. Now, one of the things, we'll get on to the final discussion of the wheel decide. All these things, there's all these levels of software coming across. So there is the idea that you need a quiz and find a word, but also the idea is that it's formatted such that it can be on a data projector and the entire class can be involved. There's no point having something small, a find a word, which is small on the page, if the entire class can't contribute to it. And then there's the other next level of automation is the wheel. So what happens is, you put in text, and you use the wheel, rotates, and it'll stop at a particular point in time, and select a person or an activity. And once that activity is selected, that is gone. That's something that, again, you want to achieve in class. Now, how I achieve that is by having bank playing cards and using acetone and this micro-abrasive pads called magic wipes. You wipe them off and put the students' names in. And so that means you can have your card deck, split the card deck, ask a student, remove that student from there so that the student's not asked the second time. And so the class finishes, you have a deck of people who you haven't asked so far, so you can spread your and randomise. Randomize things, or you can say, well, do you want someone to help you? And you go up to the deck and someone picks it up. So this is the idea of when you select someone, you don't select them a second time. There's that fairness and the ability of people to actually think of things. Now, with all this, this is in theory deployable in a classroom. When you actually get into the classroom, if you're in a hostile assessment environment, people will sort of slow you up doing it. So it's important that you actually get this technology out there for as many people to try throughout the world, so they can feed back and remove the bugs and it can sort of settle in. So this is one of the problems: if you're coming up with the technology all the time, you can deploy technology which can weary people or can get you up this path you haven't really thought about. So this is the idea of this wheel process. So this is like a charity wheel. It spins around, and when it stops at an arrow, it writes it up. The problem is, you've got a wheel of six items. What to do with it? It's got an obvious theme, and it's got something that really doesn't suit teaching. So teaching is really you start off with low level questions which lead in different directions. So if you just like questioning is like a tree structure, and where you start on the tree depends on how many students you can engage, and you might send off students in different paths, but it's definitely the history of things. Now a wheel process means that it's completely randomized. This is the overall thing in that you've got computing theory, which is how to actually get these wheels up and running, and teaching theory of how it will go, and actual theory, the actual larger theory behind things. I'm just going to talk about the larger theory behind things. So there's one of where it selects a student, and you know, for the question. And again, that shouldn't be actually up on a website. It should be an app that I can write. And I'm several technological steps away from that, so I don't know how to actually get it to a HTML file. Well, I know how to get a HTML file to actually search for a computer file, but I can't get that computer file to convert to a JSON file, then convert in. There's several steps I haven't understood. I can actually bash it up, but no one's going to download executables to allow me to do that. So it's just a bit of a head scratch how this goes. This is the class use of this thing to select students. The idea of selecting different perspectives. Now this goes to Rawlsian theory of justice. Now the Rawlsian theory of justice is something which I mentioned. I've sort of assumed that everyone would know about it. So if a definition, like there's no definition of justice, but a definition of the most just is that I can formulate a theory of how to act based on that. Would I be satisfied if I was every single participant in that group? So it may be the people, the landowners, the labourers, the marketers, the criminals, or the police and stuff like that. Can I come up with a theory of justice which is workable and criticisable from any point? So can I formulate it such that I enter this situation as a policeman and work and think through the policeman aspect? And this is his theory of. So he's an American philosopher from the 1970s, very influential in terms of, as far as I'm concerned. Now, practically, what happens is that you may get the most just system, but it's not necessarily the most workable system, and it's not necessarily a system which integrates with other parts of the economy and the history. That's okay. But bear in mind, and I'll try and understand it a bit more, I think the actual theory was based from an automating academic analysis and sort of cutting academic analysis and actually downloading it into society and saying, this is what the best we know how to do it. And so as such, rather than actually a social commentary, it is actually at its heart an education system. And one of the, I suppose, the fundamental insights here I have is the veil of ignorance compared to raw ignorance. So a lot of people who, fundamentally love themselves, I'm a natural manager, I'm a natural leader, will be ignorant of other people, other situations, history, and they'll be ignorant on a second level. They'll be ignorant of their own ignorance. So much so that they will not have time to even think of, oh, should we do this? So to give an example for Rawlsian a system of justice is a system of behaviour which results in a just outcome. And the system would be that we have this wheel, and say, for instance, say we're doing the Japanese invasion of Malaya. So you'd have Japanese civilians, Japanese industrialists, Malayans, Thai, British, Australian, and US, something like that. What happens is that you click the wheel, and the table over here will do Japanese industrials. Click the wheel, and another table will do this. And what happens is that you consider the situation from different perspectives, and eventually you work towards a solution, or you work to an understanding why these two groups don't work. So in this case, the Japanese army was, as we understand, did not have a relationship with the state. They had a relationship with the emperor, they had an understanding that they were to invade certain points on a time clock to the emperor's birthday, and historical dates. They had created a culture, stuff like that. Now, you can sort of see that academically, but what the Rawlsian theory was that you actually consider from their point of view and not consider what's right and wrong, but what they would feel is right and wrong, and see if you can actually see. It's almost like scholasticism, but scholasticism, multi-dimensional scholastics, with rather than the Pope coming in saying this text is right, that text is wrong, just consider that we really don't know which text is right and wrong, and what we can do. So it's a sort of like a scholastic tradition of analysis, line by line analysis, and seeing what you can do. But in the school situation, it can be coupled with a general education in ethics to go across. So there are certain things, like, say, when I read a New Scientist article, so I've got one out here about we must build for a warmer future, talk about the cities, talk about industrialists, talk about people in the housing market, talk about people who want to own a home for the first time, all these aspects together. So it doesn't necessarily work, but the Rawlsian thing is something that you wouldn't want to run every lesson, so you don't want to actually deploy it out at the lesson level, but you do want to deploy it at the app level. So when you've got the area of information. So this is just another general insight in that besides a limited range of resources, which are not fully automated, that we're teaching with now, don't necessarily cater for a range of abilities. So there's some people who will just, say, going across, say, to the acid and bases, which I'm looking at, acid and bases that we're looking at, there's some people who want to know just what is the chemical, what is a property at that level. And there's some people who will get there, but they need a little step, very close steps at that point in time. Now, you can say, well, in my class, I've got a third of my people who are not going to get that. Goodbye. You are going to have a lifetime just not being able to understand this. Whereas if you actually say, well, look, we'll see where they go, and the more important thing is that if I can put values and attitudes in those people, they're going to have a positive view, sort of a different view. So this is the construction of teaching resources in general. If they're content focused and not rich and fluid enough, so a part of this is to create an app bound to the podcasts, which has the various teaching resources, and it's not necessarily an out-of-date app. It's a live app. So that can be done. This is another thing in terms of that you will prove something mathematically. Yeah, okay, well, this is in my world. It's a mathematical proof. That's true. And then you go up to someone and they say, oh, I don't understand any of that. But it's not true. And you go, but to understand whether it's true or not, you have to, there's sort of this different path. So as my view is, and I'm prepared to be proven wrong, and I will be proven wrong, at least I'll go there, is the binding things with the education with a live community app. And part of the community app is having these Rawlsian discs across there. And it opens up the question then that if I have a student and if you don't give them the necessary tasks, you'll make them into what normally happens in society when they don't have enough education. People become rednecks, very ferociously viewed, and they actually, their interaction with justice actually makes them more unjust. Sort of the way that we treat other people, sort of the way we think of people, you can easily in this process of exposing them to just scenarios, if they've got a poor habit of mind to start off with men are better decision makers, if they have that coming across, they don't have a way of dealing with it. So that comes up to an area of maths that I'm looking at, which is looking at the maths of conflict, where a sort of combination between game theory and conflict. So there's sort of like three areas. There's the areas the ignorance is great. If I've got ignorance plus power is great. Then you've got the veil of ignorance, really knowing a lot but understanding your ignorance there. The other thing is to move my grade right across to the game theory aspect, and this is where people are not being straightforward with you, and they're trying to actually game the system. They don't take it as on the same level of seriousness that you're taking it. They're seeing it as a society as there for the plundering, and so in this there's some mathematics involved with it, which is, I think I've got a fundamental model based on belief, desire, action, sort of loosely related to that, and that's sort of in a reverse of it, is competency. So if something happens and it's not good, or it is good, or you just ask, is that competent? Has that actually person exercised, or has the situation exercised justice, openness, forewarning, adequate information? That's the competence. And then there's poison. That is there a potential reason for that person acting that way? Or is there a reason to believe, to what extent can we to associate that behaviour, this contrary antisocial behaviour, with a poisonous intent? Not to assess someone, but how much is this associatable with it? So you could argue against, no, it's not. They're actually quite seriously confused. Or it could be that people are actually running a game. So my theory for aggressive or unethical game theory would be poison. And then the last question is to say, to what extent does this harm? And this is the actual the cost of this. And you may well let that through to the keeper. That's what I call is accepting harm to. Your strategy to the calm. So this is after you've put the kids through the Rawlsian wheel. So let's do it. You've got so we're in several generations ahead of you. So instead of just a textbook, we have an app, a live app, where people can go and get different resources from. And then we have the Rawlsian wheel, which is an ethical experience for them. And then we have a selection of variety of tools that they can use to address ethical situations. And so I myself, who've come up looking after kids, have said, taken a lot of effort here. I've spoken to Anne Alley, she's the Muslim academic in Australian Parliament. Great thing. She sent me out her papers. We chatted for an hour. I basically said, look, I'm on the case. Don't you worry. Don't worry, I'm on the case. That's all I could say that I'm looking at. So I looked at one theory of what to do after this. So I'm really looking at that area of education. And let's hope that we can get there. So just in summary, let's go back and summarise where we've come through. One is that very first light thing of increasing the efficiency of your writing. So you write something for it, you do a podcast, you have to write a few lines for it, like the title and stuff like that, and then just publish away, do all the enclosures, do everything, and eventually get it to the RSS feed. There's nothing more aggravating than having to go back into Blogger and then just tick it over the next thing, or you WordPress is just insane. So there's that area. Then there's the reduction of effort to do with when you're doing a podcast series, you can go across, or the error associated with it. And then there's finally the set of long range, what's it, technology, educational, social strategies, how they all link together. And I suppose what's fascinating is that I think Pasteur said luck happens, favours luck, favours the prepared mind. So when I see this and I know the rules in technology, the rules in philosophy, which, you know, that is what we should educate people on. We have to also educate people that that's not the way it's going to operate, but by going through that, you can do it. So, but having all that, the looking at the HTML5, looking at the structure of trying to get into a lesson, comes all together as a larger strategy, and sort of the understanding that as I proceed forward, if I just do this just by myself, I'll be nailed, because what happens is that this is very early days. We actually need more theory, more technology. We need more technology, we need more structure in order to get there. So if I'm thrown in at this stage, I won't, I don't know what the success rate is. The reason to do it is a mathematical reason. It's not that I can say I can definitely achieve it, but if I can get it out there to other teachers and other people can try, so say there's 100 people out there and one person tries, that's going to make the huge difference at the end. Thanks for listening. It's 51 minutes talking in this. That's pretty amazing. Thanks a lot for listening. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.